Hey, good evening, Bob. We're back. We're doing Enemy Sessions number 8. Today is Monday the 6th of June 2011 in Hawaii. The local time is 11 p.m. New Zealand, it's Tuesday the 7th of June. And today we're moving into May. We're looking at Inscriptorium again. This is Andrew McLuhan's blog where he's discussing the marginalia in his father's library. I think we've got a very short one to get through, and then we've got some meatier ones later on in the session. So.
Okay, this is good, Andrew. So it's called Profit Margin, Oracle of the Information Age, and it's written on May 10th, 2011. Apologies, dear reader, that I have not had time to make many new posts here as of late. I have, however, been making use of Twitter for acting on shorter discoveries from the library, tweeting as at @mmreadsbooks. A bit of a joke on the purported bumper sticker which read, quote, Marshall McLuhan reads books, a sticker I have heard of, never seen. Thanks for reading, Andrew. What about what's he posting on the Twitter? Have you checked that?
Yeah, he just posts an occasional quote or some excerpt. He's recently just gone through the situation around his death, but no new information thus far.
Okay, we don't have to follow the tweet right yet.
No.
Okay, so there's this WCM who has been posting comments regularly. He says, Andrew, if you have a chance sometime, it would be good to learn the source for the Marshall McLuhan tweets, book date that they are from, perhaps in the blog entry, especially for, quote, all pre-alphabetic societies are made up of robots. Another one, advertising tries to adjust us to its world. There we become servo mechanism. Quote from George Meredith, the true hero, whether prince or potboy, does not plot. Fortune does all for him, says George Meredith. Would be interesting to know, for example, the date of the book where the latter appears, therefore at what time McLuhan was still thinking about Meredith. Thanks and cheers. Any idea who WCM is?
No.
Okay, so all pre-alphabetic societies are made up of robots. McLuhan does say in War and Peace that, War and Peace in the Global Village, that Pavlov's experiment showed Western man that he'd been a robot for 500 years. So there's visual robots and tribal robots, two different kinds of robots.
Yep.
Did you know that?
Yeah,
you know,
yep.
The visual man was a kind of a robot, but now he's saying the pre-alphabetic societies are made up of robots. It has to be a different kind of robot. Doesn't Bruce Powers make that distinction? Angels versus...
Yeah, the angels versus robots. It's in 89, but it's it runs all the way through from 44. I mean, back in Wyndham Lewis, Lemuel and Lillipot, he's talking about robots. You know, men who no longer understand the world they live in operate as robots.
Okay, so there's no context for that sentence. We know this. Advertising tries to adjust us to its world. There we become server mechanism. So, on a very contemporary level, the medium is the message, is the term when you're applying, when you're talking about advertising. The medium is the massage. Advertising tries to adjust us to its world. There we become servo mechanisms. Now, that's the analog media period. The digital media, we at least have the patina of deciding our own fate, because you can interact. You can alter the programming that comes at you. I wonder if that's what McLuhan meant in 69 when he said advertising was dead. Was it the one-way song was ending, and he saw that happening in the 70s? Just a question, Andrew.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think a lot of McLuhan's criticism of advertising, at least the early, well, in the 60s stuff, where he's talking about how they fold us back upon ourselves. And so I wonder it, you know, it raises an interesting question of mirrors in some respect, because if we become in a multimedia situation where we've got a multiplicity of extensions that are hybridizing and interacting with each other, then that possibility of any one medium acting as a mirror to fold yourself back upon yourself becomes punier and punier, and becomes, I guess, less inclined to affect some sort of narcosis.
You're saying that you don't fold your back up. You don't fold yourself back into yourself as you get used to the onslaught of different media.
Well, no. It's only a smaller and smaller portion or fragment of yourself is folded back upon yourself. Like maybe in a television situation where you haven't got a computer, what have you, then it's a fairly comprehensive self that is folded back upon the self. But when you're starting to get a more multimedia situation, then possibly you're only dealing with a fragment. I don't know, it's just something I've been toying with recently.
Well, Coker makes an interesting statement, I think, in Panic Encyclopedia, that the audience for the TV environment of the 80s is indifferent. It's not affected anymore, is basically what he says. In different rivulets of experience pour over the semiconductor of the audience.
Yep.
And so he's picking up that there's not an action happening, a massaging going on, other than you're massaged into indifference. Is that a robot?
I know. It's a different kind of robot than perhaps the robot that McLuhan's talking about in the 60s.
Yeah, 40s. You'd have the rhythmic robot of the tribal society, the kinetic robot of the literate society or industrial society, and then you'd have the inner-tripping and folding back in itself robot of the electronic society, and then the non-robot in the digital society watching the Android meme be a robot.
Yeah, a post-tactile where it's almost... is Croker pointing out at more the impotence? There's that sideline spectator type situation, yeah, that he seems to point towards.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'd say that. And then McLuhan used to like to... quote James Joyce's line, the city is paralysis. So you have different levels of paralysis. External paralysis and then interior landscape paralysis. And then death paralysis.
Yeah, death's a pretty big one, Bob.
Yeah. Well, that's the being in the 80s and 90s until the internet. The internet really gets people livened up again. They put on the patina of dialogue.
Yeah, it'd be interesting what McLuhan would have said on that one. Like, I notice in his diary or something, you know, where he turns up in London or Greece. You know, it's Greece after the reintroduction of television. He's walking around noting that people are a lot duller, or you know, they've got a patina of dullness about them. And so whether he'd pick up on the some sort of vitality that is possibly rejuvenated with the internet.
Yeah, I think that McLuhan would not have been able to handle the internet. It's just like Joyce couldn't take the post-bomb world. Zappa couldn't take the music world of the internet and digital music. And McLuhan couldn't take the digital face. They just don't. What would they say? McLuhan go around like Tim Leary and just sort of smile nicely because there was nothing more to say. Everybody was having a good time. Just be pleasant, you know. It would have been. You see, it's almost like the creator couldn't figure out what they would do, so he had to kill them off. He just couldn't figure out how to continue the story. He couldn't figure out how Zappa would react, couldn't figure out how McLuhan would react, and he couldn't figure out what Joyce was doing. You know, some deus ex machina or some Gnostic demiurge, that kind of god, some monster in the sky, just didn't know how to think up the next level. And, well, we end up talking about me again. We're not encouraged that.
Okay, so let's go on and let's see if there's anything else. So the next one is, so that was a real short one. So we've got a little bit more here on the weight collider scope, and we've got a comment by Mark Stellman further down the way. So we've got weight kaleidoscope. It's May the 17th, 2011. So weight kaleidoscope. On page 132 of Continuities and Cultural Evolution, Margaret Mead, 1964, Yale University Press, Marshall writes in pencil, "She hasn't a clue about causes of cultural change." Further on in the volume, there is a pink page from a memo pad with "Write Mead" on it. On that page is written, "Weight kaleidoscope."
Now, weight kaleidoscope. Kaleidoscope is a term, I think, right after the 10th Thunder. Before or after the 10th Thunder in Finnegan's Wake. All right? So it's an important term. He's spelling it the way it's spelled in Finnegan's Wake.
Okay.
Yeah. Continue. Typically,
there are a few newspaper clippings tucked inside. From the August 9th, 1964 New York Times Book Review, a review of the book by Sol Tax. Marshall would often include a clipping of a review into the relevant book. Also, there is a clipping, "A Day of Drums" by Dennis Braithwaite on the one-year anniversary of John F. Kennedy's death. Throughout Mead's book, there are many penciled notations, many C/M and C minus N, so that's center to margins and center without margins in the margins. And in the back of book, many notes with page references. The above bit about change is also referenced in the back. 132, clueless about change, 162. Page 162 has the margin note SI/SC. Thanks for reading, Andrew.
Yeah, SI is sensory impact, and SC is sensory closure, and that is from Project 69. And this is when he's reading this in the 64 period, right, when Understanding Media comes out,
yeah.
Right? Let's assume it's a new book. Now, when Marshall says that she has no clue about causes of cultural change, he says that about everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and it's actually, I don't know, he's right. They have no clue about his kind of cultural change, but people are all talking about change, you know, in all fields. And the Marxists have a theory of change, and he actually, if you read enough of Marshall, you see he's throwing that one around all the time. And it's a real one-note response. So the issue comes down to whether Marshall's right or not. Otherwise, he's wasted all his criticism on one bet. The thing is, what happens when these people do not engage Marshall? Margaret Mead does not make a point of interacting with them. You know, they don't respond to this. And so he carries on marking them, but nobody cares.
Yeah, it's, I guess he... Well, in this instance, it took him 10 years to write the letter to Margaret Mead because we don't seem to have any other correspondence between the two until 1975.
Yeah, I think I've told the story before.
1973.
Right. I think I've told the story before that he once comments that Margaret Mead was at every, what was that, Aegisthus, the Greek guy who had the boat out in the Mediterranean, you know, summer.
Yeah,
and... his magazine was called Aegisthus, I think, and he points out that Margaret Mead was at every one of them, and this was highly suspect. It seemed Marshall was pointing out, you have to be suspicious that Margaret Mead had to be at every one of them. That meant she was doing some serious surveillance on it, or Belinda the Hen, Issy, doing some Issy control. So, of course, LaRouche develops that in great detail. He's done whole magazines on the evil of Margaret Mead. I mean, when in 1977 Tom Wolfe came to the University of Toronto and spoke in Convocation Hall, and Barbara Frum, who was the Walter Cronkite, or I guess today the Katie Couric of the News World of Canada, as back before the internet, and she had to introduce him. And then she had to sit up there while Wolfe made his remarks. His lecture went on for quite a while, and you could see McLuhan sitting up in the stands chuckling and laughing. It would seem to be at Thompson's remarks, but he was also chuckling and laughing when there was nothing funny going on. And the next day, Marshall pointed out to us that he said, wasn't Barbara Frumrather wooden? She didn't have a clue. She has no clue about the causes of cultural change. It's like he applied it to everybody. He met somebody on the street, bumped into somebody, and then he stumbled away and he said, that guy has no clue what the cultural change is about us. So what are the causes of cultural change, Andrew, as McLuhan means it?
The causes of cultural change, yeah, that's an interesting one. I was dialoguing with Jerry Fialka on this point, and coming down to that, is McLuhan a technological determinist? And then,
how do you dialogue with him? You mean by email?
Yeah, just by email. And
it's about what you're calling. Okay, what is the dialogue about?
Well, at this stage, it's about whether McLuhan is a technological determinist, and so I was trying to explain how you can present McLuhan as not a determinist and the various arguments around that. But this is, you know, fundamentally it's the causes of cultural change is technological change, and technological change, when you push through, and I guess McLuhan's understanding, it disappears into a ground. So it's, in some respects, it disappears into an everything, which is a nothing, which is...
Okay, well, here's... Most people would be able to think about technology as a cause of cultural change today. Most North Americans generally would have a clue of that because they've experienced it in their own lives so much, so radically the last 30 years. So I would think that there's more sophisticated cultural change going on, which is what he gets at with his tetrad.
Yep.
It's not just moving forward. Everybody knows that technology changes society, but they don't know about the... multi-dimensional or going in many directions, tetradic aspect of change. So maybe that's what he means.
Yeah, well, it would warrant. I think that maybe this is what we have to talk about, like, because it does get complicated. I mean, when Marshall's talking about technology, he dissolves when you look. In my experience, when you look closely at what he actually means and how he describes technology, he dissolves the term. Like when he's talking about radio, he's not talking about any box. He's talking about the whole the various grounds for radio, which almost go in infinite regress. Cinema, he says, was invented before the actual cinema was invented, sort of thing. And yeah. So it's, again, it relocates to the notion of technique. But then if you're looking at the early McLuhan, which, as we've established, never goes away, then you're talking about human drives, both psychological and collective, and desires, and that also never disappears. And then as we were talking about mum today, it's that we're talking about the verbum and the centrality of the verbum. So it's not a simple thing, I don't think, in McLuhan.
No, and you could make a case that the cause of cultural change is sin. His definition of sin is the human propensity to ignore what's going on, and that's why there's change.
Ultimately, if you push it to its absolute eschatological end point, yeah, that would be a really powerful way of integrating, I guess, the internal and external, which we established already were merely visual, determined on by a visual gradient.
Right. A side thing I was thinking about on the way to the beach today about radio. Most people don't know that radio is not speech. Radio is that silence, the simultaneous electronic buzz, not the speech content. And it's a perfect example that the, what's his name, De Saussure? Saussure and those guys start talking about language, analyzing language as a form 100 years ago. And they're doing it because it's the content of the electric environment. And what those guys miss, and maybe Joyce saw, what they miss is that they are looking at language, or as Marshall said, radio created depth criticism. They're looking at language in depth and they're not noticing the actual new language around them, which is the silence of radio.
Yeah.
You know, that's an important point to get, is that the reason everybody gets into structuralism, and this is where Terence Gordon really blows it in his biography of McLuhan, to talk about McLuhan being a structuralist, and to think then, to try to map how McLuhan studied speech and the dynamics of speech like the Saussure and those people did, misses this simple fact. No, the others didn't see the post-language environment, and that they were just studying a rear-view mirror environment, and they only were noticing it because it was rear-view mirror.
Yeah, I guess he's I've been going back recently to the Project in Understanding Media, and then Media Log 3 there. He takes on the information theory and the game theory people there, because he says information theory people are unaware that they're dealing with two media at once, as well as game theory people. When we speak of information, we speak of one medium coming through another medium. And so in painting, it's impossible to talk of content because there is no medium contained.
No, that's very good quote. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. There's two media involved when you're engaging a medium.
Always. So when people say technology causes change, I find that's really, do they have that sensitivity to the interfacing and interplay of two media? I don't know about that.
Yeah, I think McLuhan should have written, she has no clue about my causes of culture. my comprehensive understanding of causes. Because if you just keep it to simple cause of cultural change, it's like money. Everybody knows what money is. Everybody has an opinion about it. Anybody can talk about change and think they understand it or have a view on what is the factor. You know, so I give him a D for his marginal notation. It's not accurate enough. In reference to his own language and what he's about, he should have put a more comprehensive definition of what people didn't have a clue about. Now, maybe it's only written for himself. Or was he writing it for those scholars to note it? So if he was planning it for others to read it, then I'm glad we were able to record what he should have written.
Yeah, he's just creating gaps for involvement and participation, Bob. You know, it's he knew the fault of Milton and how Milton got dragged through the mud for having the audacity to complete a work and make it so perfect.
Yes, but this is not... This is a tissue paper, wet tissue. You can't. There's no involvement evoked by the way he's saying it. He's not leaving out any gap. There's nothing there. He fails to create the tension of the gap.
speaking on the just I've got a fairly personal reflection on McLuhan's calculus. You know, his little notes, the C/M and the C-M. That's through everything. It's quite fascinating how he developed it, and it took me a while to decipher. But it's the speed that he moved through books and classified them according to his calculus. You know, center margin, center without margins, figure without ground, SC, SEI. It's amazing.
Yeah, and in his Skeleton Key, Defending Its Wake, he uses this for Joseph Campbell's summary of the wake. And I always wondered when was he doing this, making this annotations, and one would think maybe the 60s, but maybe the 70s. But this is good because it shows you us he was doing it in 64, that early. So that means Skeleton Key might have been done in the early 60s. I mean, this is 64, right? Yeah, there are newspaper clippings, August 9, 64. It's for me, it's useful to see how early he does C/M, which is visual space, and C-M, which is center without margins. That means acoustic space. Center's everywhere. No margins. You get that?
Yeah.
If you have a center and a margin, that's visual space. Let's see...
Just as an aside, does LaRouche make the case that Mead was on the CIA payroll?
Oh yeah, yeah, major, major. She was higher pay grade than the CIA.
Hmm.
Yeah, because her husband was Gregory Bateson, and Mark Stallman, he's the one who helped found material to show that Gregory Bateson was a major MKUltra character. He conducted LSD tests in Palo Alto, including on Ken Kesey and Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. They were, I don't know if he personally was there, but the program he set up in the late 50s, early 60s, dispensing LSD, that was Margaret Mead's husband, but I don't know if he was married to her at that point. I'd have to check that, the dates of when they split. But it's curious we bring up Mark Stallman. Now, isn't this fun? You bring up LaRouche. I tell you about Mark Stallman provides the materials for LaRouche when he went to the archives in Washington to lay out the pattern of interpretation that Margaret Mead is quite high up in the National Security Council brain trust. And we have a remark from Mark Stallman on this very column. How's that?
Interesting.
Yeah, so on May 17th, Mark Stallman says, Andrew, are there any works by Norbert Wiener in the collection? Now, we know that Mark goes on about Wiener all the time and always points out that his father was in the salon at MIT when cybernetics, the term, was coined. So again, he's going to mention it again. That's what he says. In the introduction to Wiener's famous 1948 book, Cybernetics, he specifically names Mead and her then-husband, Gregory Bateson, as attempting to get him to join the effort to control society using cybernetics. He declined based on their lack of understanding about how society actually works. My father was a protege of Wiener and told me he was there late night when they coined the term cybernetics with the help of a large bottle of Chianti. Mark Stallman, Brooklyn, New York. So this is the main point that Mark Stallman has contributed to the MKUltra, the Mediacology list since 1998. This was his main point. He saw Wiener as a victim of the machinations of Mead and Bateson, just as he saw later McLuhan the victim of these machinations, because he wouldn't play ball with their 1984 kind of vision.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one. Like, I've got a letter from McLuhan to Hall where in 64, where McLuhan's looking for funding for his sensory typology tests, and he's asking Hall if there's some Washington funds available, perhaps from the CIA.
Yeah, no, he you know, I've told you about before when one of the spin-offs of the Mead and Bateson committees was the anthropological movement, and basically looking at how the medium is the message, and the key figure was Ray Birdwhistle, and Ted Carpenter and McLuhan went to that conference in 1951-52 and were a bit upset at the Machiavellian move, supposedly, and set up their project to start explorations to counter that. And that's not understood. I mean, part of what Mark is saying here, Marshall was out to undermine also, and but that would not, as Mary McLuhan once told me, her father, Marshall, always said, never name your enemy directly. Never confront him directly. So Marshall wouldn't have a problem hanging out with the CIA, get some grants from them. He was, I don't know if you call that Machiavellian himself, but he had a larger vision, so he didn't worry about the ethics of who he was interacting with in conventional knowledge. Because his knowledge allowed him to take a sympathetic position to the Big Brother people. They were in trouble as much as anybody else was. So he didn't have any, it didn't seem to have any ethics on that level, which bothered Ted Carpenter later. He didn't like the pictures of McLuhan with Hubert Humphrey in the mid-60s during the anti-Vietnam War depress protests. So McLuhan, in a way, he was getting a grant from the Ford Foundation. He probably understood how that was a Big Brother operation, and he didn't mind getting a grant from them in 1952-53. Remember, he was going to distract the triggerman. Well, you got to make the triggerman know you're around.
Yeah.
So the best way to do that is apply for a grant from them.
Yeah, there is, just as an add-on, there's a reasonable amount of, well, where did I get this? There's, at the MIT archives, there's a couple of letters between McLuhan and Norbert Wiener. And so these are back in 51 where McLuhan's saying that he's paid special attention to cybernetics and the human use of human beings. So there should be something around with notation in it.
I think the book on the human uses of human beings or cybernetics, the book that McLuhan read was Don Field's. Because Don Field brought it to him in 1950 at the age of 22 from Yale, turned McLuhan on to Wiener, and I think Michael Evans and I were at his place where he showed us or talked about he got that copy back. So he has his own copy of Cybernetics or the Human Use of Human Beings with Marshall's notations in it.
That's great.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Don may have given me a Xerox, or I Xerox, the words in that, you know, what was written on inside the book. That'd be somewhere in my archives. I think he allowed me to Xerox Don's copy of a Wiener book that McLuhan borrowed and put all those annotations in. So there may not be any works by Norbert Wiener in Eric's collection. They're at Don Thiel's home.
So that means they will have gone to the St. Mike's Library, perhaps?
Yeah. So, Mark, go to the St. Mike's Library. You might find it in Don Thiel's collection.
Yeah, I was just reading through this letter while you were talking, and it appears McLuhan made a big punt to try and get Wiener interested in Wyndham Lewis, The Art of Being Ruled.
Well, he was doing the same with Innes. That's what he said to Innes, too. So he was on. Now, this is interesting. You're the one who found the letter in the archives in the late 40s where he's telling Kenner that, I think I'm going to start talking up Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah. The time is right now.
Yeah, the time is right. That's 49-50. And so in 51, he's writing to Innes and making a big deal out of The Art of Being Ruled, saying it's more important or is as important as Machiavelli's The Prince.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know he was also telling Wiener. He was tossing around all over the place. But the knowledge that Carpenter brought about the Eskimos, Harold Innes, there may be a bit of a different strategy by 53 when they do explorations.
Yeah.
He may have dropped the, it's the same period, 50, 51, 52, when he's looking into secret society. So he was probably possessed by the Lewis mode right then. You know, the Lewis mode had come back. One more grasp at using Lewis, and then he drops it once he gets to explorations.
Yeah, and shifts mode.
Yeah. Maybe because McCarthyism took over. So, you know, if everybody else is conspiracy-oriented, you don't want to do Lewis anymore. You want to take the other view. The Joycean view, the bottom-up view.
Yeah, there's another interesting note where I guess that sort of has McLuhan to Wiener in 10th of November 1951 that has some relevance to Margaret Mead is even back then he's quite aware that the admin have got a wider range of social data available to them than the sociologist, and this doesn't please them at all. And so in a certain sense, he's already seen, you know, from the early 50s that the whole anthropology, sociology project that Mead has been totally obsolesced by these massive international advertising houses.
Yeah, now... He doesn't mention Mead, but you're including Mead in the fact he says anthropology there.
Well, I guess presumably Mead comes onto the scene shortly later, but she's only one person.
Okay. Do you know that he talks about Margaret Mead in The Mechanical Bride?
Yes.
Yeah, and he lists off several artifacts, Mead and others. And it seems like he is praising their multi-level approach. I forget what he called it. Toynbee did it. Mead did it. A couple other people. And he saw it in Picasso and Across the Arts. He's actually pointing out the effects of a medium, but he does not name the medium that they're miming, right? And so it appears that he's he's celebrating Meade as an example of the new kind of scholarship. You know, within 10 minutes, we're going to find out, well, no, they're just knee-jerk response to the radio environment. Like he said, depth criticism was created by radio.
Yep.
So I think he was already critical of Meade before the Mechanical Bride came out in 51. But you wouldn't get that from Mechanical Bride. And another aspect is he sees sociology and psychology, don't know so much about anthropology. Sociology and psychology are the last gasp of books, are the last artifacts of visual space. Like novels, in a way, have become cliché, so the novel turned into science, known as sociology and psychology, is the last stand of book content.
Yeah, and Footprints in the Sands of Crime. Okay, so this is reprinted in the Sewanee Review in 1946. He says, we must study sociology and social engineering as morbid symptoms because the impulse behind them are technological derivatives.
Very good sentence. Now, how did you find that? What did you put in to get that in your archive?
Sociology.
Well, have you ever read that is perceptively now before?
Yes. Yeah, no, I understood these. He's got an equally dim view of psychology, but sociology comes up again and again. Like, I guess I was sensitive to it because my first undergraduate degree is in sociology. And so I always paid attention to McLuhan's reference to sociological theorists.
Right. So there, that statement, 45, 46, is McLuhan as technological determinist right there. That's it. I mean, there he is. He's saying that they're knee-jerk reflections of a technological environment.
Yep. But then again, it's right beside jazz as an imitation of human panic. And so he's doing this collage situation where he's just collaging knee-jerk reactions.
You mean that sentence about jazz is in the same paragraph?
No, it's in the next page.
But the same article?
Yep.
Yeah, yes, you should, that technological derivatives, you should type that out. That's a good quote to put on mom.
Yeah, on this matter, though, you know, we were saying technological determinists, the article sort of starts, or at least somewhere around the beginning of the piece, it's talking about technology developed by reason, enslaved to appetite, and it's the unlimited power of man over nature, and blind appetite fed by pride, fear, and hate. So that's quite an interesting spin on the, you know, what is the actual causes of social change.
Where's that appetite sentence? Where's that from?
This is still in the same essay, Footprints in the Sands of Crime.
Yeah, which essay I have, a very good essay. Remember I mentioned last week on Mum or on Enemy about appetite?
It's
emphasized in Lemmy and Lilliput. Well, here it is again. See, appetite is man, and media are an extension of the appetite. So, or the passions.
Yeah, yeah, and so after that he moves on to talking about emotional illiteracy. So he's not I guess it depends on how you understand the emotions and the relationship to the spiritual state of humankind. But you know, he seems to be saying that had we been emotionally literate, as in we no longer divorced the head from the heart, thought from feeling, then we wouldn't be in a position to enslave reason to appetite. So here, emotionality or emotional literacy is held out as a certain key to understanding and possibly curtailing certain processes of social change.
Yeah, I think that's the hot era pre-TV where people were not emotional. You had to have a detached point of view. So he's providing an anti-environment by emphasizing emotions. But once the cool environment comes in with television and everybody gets emotional and panics, he adopts a technical, quote, scientific stance. And seems to be very cold. What do you think of that? So emotional literacy is passion literacy, and media extensions of people's emotions or appetites. It's a deeper definition of emotion, not limited to sentiment, which is, did you read the Love article I posted?
I remember that, actually. But, yeah, it's quite, in one sense, it's really conventional, but it's still quite beautiful.
It's a great article. So you read it in the archives. Remember it. Yeah, it's really interesting. So I'm thinking now that he was a technological determinist until television.